I'm Charlie Brower. I'm one of the third-year residents at the University of Cincinnati Emergency Medicine Program, and I'm going to be talking about the SQID protocol, subcutaneous insulin and diabetic ketoacidosis, impacts on ED operational metrics. So I chose this article because I am very much interested in operations and also because I want to see how many times I can say SQID in a short period of time. Regarding some background here, so diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, is a very resource-intensive condition that contributes to significant morbidity and mortality among patients with diabetes mellitus. It accounts for over 200,000 ED visits a year, or approximately 8.9 ED visits per 1,000 adults with diabetes, and essentially accounts for over 500,000 annual hospital days. This accounts to annual hospital costs of $5.1 billion. In most hospitals, DKA is managed by initiating patients on intravenous insulin infusions that often require admission to an ICU or a step-down level of care due to need for frequent laboratory testing and monitoring. However, over the past 20 years, with the advent of subcutaneous fast-acting insulin analogs, there's been multiple studies that have demonstrated that using these subcutaneous insulin protocols for the treatment of mild to moderate DKA is both safe and cost-effective. So in the context of increasing ED and hospital crowding, as well as limited ICU availability, this study aimed to evaluate the impact of a subcutaneous insulin, or SQID, protocol in the treatment of DKA on emergency department length of stay and ICU admission rates. This was a prospectively derived single-center pre-post study comparing the impact of the SQID protocol with a traditional intravenous insulin infusion protocol for patients with mild to moderate DKA. The study included patients with hyperglycemia defined as a fingerstick blood glucose greater than 300, as well as a positive point-of-care ketone test greater than 1.1 millimoles per liter. Patients with severe DKA, which was defined as either having a bicarb lower than 10 or a pH less than 7, were excluded from the protocol. Additionally, any patients who were less than 18 years old were also excluded from analysis. Additional exclusion criteria from the SQID protocol included pregnancy, concomitant serious infection, concerns for MI, altered mental status, active comorbidities such as ESRD, congestive heart failure, or the use of immunosuppressants, need for a surgical procedure, and determination by the ED or inpatient team that a patient was too ill for the designated floor to which these patients were going to be dispoed, which was an inpatient observation unit run by hospitalist physicians. Regarding the methodology, the SQID protocol was launched in June 2021, and data was captured on patients following a pre-planned 5-week washout period. In this protocol, all diabetic patients who presented to triage were screened with fingerstick blood glucose testing, and if positive, point-of-care ketone testing was then initiated. If the point-of-care ketone test met the threshold of 1.1, the patients would automatically be ordered for a BMP, whole blood potassium, and a venous blood gas, and a physician would be notified that the patient may have DKA. At that point, the EMR would have a best practice advisory, or BPA, that would signal the clinician as to whether or not they were a candidate for the study pathway, including inclusion and exclusion criteria. Clinicians then determined if patients met laboratory criteria for DKA and would assess if they were appropriate for the SQID protocol versus the traditional intravenous insulin infusion protocol. After ED evaluation was complete, patients in the SQID protocol were admitted to an inpatient observation unit, whereas patients in the traditional infusion protocol were admitted to the ICU, as this hospital did not have a step-down level of care unit. The study's primary outcomes were the operational impacts of the SQID protocol on ED length of stay and ICU admissions rates. The impact on ED length of stay was evaluated by comparing length of stay for patients in the SQID cohort compared to the insulin infusion cohort in the post-intervention period, as well as compared to two historical control periods, a pre-intervention period, as well as a pre-COVID period, as this study was conducted in the height of COVID. Impact on ICU admission rates was evaluated solely by comparing the post-intervention period to these two historical control periods. Secondary outcomes included fidelity to the protocol, as well as safety of the intervention. Fidelity was evaluated by ensuring that patients received the standard Q2-hour glucose checks, whereas safety was evaluated by determining the number of instances in which someone required rescue dextrose for blood glucose levels less than 70. So during the six-month study period from August 2021 to February 22, 177 adult patients were enrolled, 78 within the SQID cohort and 99 within the traditional cohort. Additionally, retrospectively identified controls were identified in both the pre-intervention and pre-COVID periods. Of the 177 patients in the post-intervention period, 76 were admitted to an ICU, whereas the remaining 101 were admitted to a medical floor. Of those who went to the floor, 73 were managed on the SCWID protocol, and the other 28 were managed on an insulin infusion. And we have to assume that they likely closed their gap and were able to come off the insulin infusion before being admitted to this floor. Median ED length of stay was significantly shorter for the SCWID cohort compared to the control cohorts during the post-intervention period. The decrease in ED length of stay ranged anywhere from 1.4 to 3.6 hours, depending on which comparison group was used. ICU admission rates for mild to moderate DKA were lower in the post-intervention period at 42.9% compared to the pre-intervention period, which was 46%, and the pre-COVID control period, which was 49.1%. However, these results were not statistically significant. Fidelity to the protocol was high, with patients actually often receiving blood glucose testing more than every 2 hours, and there were no differences in safety as measured by need for rescue dextrose, with 2.7% of the patients in the SCWID protocol requiring rescue dextrose in comparison to 3.6% in the traditional pathway. The main takeaway from this protocol is that using a subcutaneous fast-acting insulin for the treatment of mild to moderate DKA is effective, safe, and reduces ED length of stay by approximately 3 hours. Given record levels of ED overcrowding and boarding with limited ICU availability across the U.S., alternative treatment pathways such as this to improve ED throughput are essential. Limitations of this study include differences between the cohorts in the SCWID protocol and the traditional pathway, as well as this being a single-center study limiting its generalizability, especially with respect to variable operational design from hospital to hospital. Patients in the SCWID cohort were younger and more likely to have a lower acuity, but this was intentional in that the protocol is designed for healthier patients. Further, the authors speculate that this protocol may be appropriate for sicker patient populations, though further research is needed. Interestingly, I learned through reading this article that our institution actually has a subcutaneous, fast-acting insulin protocol meant for patients being admitted to ED observation. For the most part, almost all patients who present with DKA and RED are typically initiated on an insulin infusion, which will require admission to a step-down level of care. In the context of our hospital overcrowding, this essentially means that every single one of those patients will board an RED until their gap is closed and they can come off an infusion to be downgraded to floor status. In this context, I think we need to really work on adopting a similar protocol to improve ED throughput and help combat boarding in RED.